on my computer as well. Today is Easter Sunday, and the topic I want to talk about is, where did Jesus go? Where did he go? My wife sent me a daily devotion email that she subscribes to. It has to do, or it originates from the Lutheran Church, and it quoted Matthew chapter 22, verse 37 to 41 in common English. And it basically said, love the Lord your God with all of your heart and with all of your soul and with all of your mind. This is the first and greatest commandment. And the second is like it. Love your neighbor as yourself. All the law and the prophets hang on these two commandments. I found that very interesting. Seems to me that Jesus demonstrated repeatedly these concepts. He didn't just talk about them, he lived them. And his activities throughout the Bible offer proof of that. After miracles were performed, he gave God the credit for the power that allowed these changes to occur instantly and dramatically. Jesus also demonstrated a love for his fellow man and women, the people of his time, by being inclusive, much to the chagrin of the Pharisees and others seeking more authority, power, and influence over the populace. These two fundamental principles, these two laws or commandments, would be life-changing and world-changing if people knew about them, accepted them, and actually applied them. Where did Jesus go? Where did his teachings go? On the one hand, it is interesting, and on the other, perhaps disheartening, to see what happened to Jesus. I have some information in front of me that is an extract of varying points of view and claims by varying religions around the planet. These claims don't sound exactly like what Jesus was talking about. In 1879, Christian Science began, and part of their claim is, Christian Science is unerring and divine. Outside of Christian Science, all is vague and hypothetical, the opposite of truth. The Seventh-day Adventist, which began in 1863, claimed that the General Conference of Seventh-day Adventists is the highest authority that God has upon earth. Jehovah's Witnesses, beginning in 1870, say Jehovah's Witnesses alone are God. Jehovah's Witnesses alone are God's true people, and all others without exception are followers of the devil. At Armageddon, all of Earth's inhabitants, except Jehovah's Witnesses, will be wiped out of existence. The Mormons, Mormonism began in 1830, say, there is no salvation outside the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. Everybody, unless they repent and work righteously, will be damned, except Mormons. Christadelphians, which began in 1848, say, none but Christadelphians can be saved. Islam began in 633 A.D. Say, Muhammad is the messenger of God, the last and final exponent of God's mind, the seal of the prophets. The Divine Light Mission began in 1960, and it says that the Guru Maharaj Ji alone has the key to the knowledge of the source of God. The Unification Church in 1954, when it began, said, "Only the Lord of the Second Advent, the Reverend Sun Myung Moon, will be powerful enough to complete the restoration of man to God." Krishna Consciousness in 1966 said, "Direct love for the Lord Krishna in the form of chanting, singing, and dancing is the best way to rid the soul of ignorance." The Church of Scientology began in 1953 and said, "It is only through the exercise of the principles of Dianetics that there is real hope for happiness in this lifetime and the eventual freeing of the soul from death." The Children of God began in 1968, say, "No power in the world can stand against the power of David." That David happens to be David Berg, the sex leader. And the Catholic Church, which dates itself back to the time of the apostles, say, "No one can be saved without that faith which the Holy Catholic Apostolic Roman Church holds, believes, and teaches. The one true church established on earth by Jesus Christ, to whom alone it belongs to judge the meaning and interpretation of the Holy Scriptures." And I didn't go through the various Protestant sects of Lutheranism and Methodism and the Baptists and Presbyterianism and on and on and on and on. But it's amazing. In all of that, where did Jesus go? How did his words get so lost, so ignored, so corrupted? I don't know how many words are attributed to Jesus in the New Testament. I don't know how many concepts were included or could be said to be involved in those words of Jesus, but I think it would be a rewarding study to be able to extract all the words, depending on which version of the Bible that you want to look at, and extract all of his words and see what he is claimed to have said, and then look into those words and find the meaning of them. But if I go back to the chapter and verses that I read from Matthew, the first commandment and the second commandment, those are the greatest. And if we just stop right there, we would be somewhere. The other day I read an article online about an Orlando, Florida doctor who posted a sign on his office door asking people who had supported President Obama, and as a result of that, the health care change, to go find another doctor. It looks like this man is fighting over political views. On the other hand, because his wife is running for political office as a Republican, maybe he's trying to enlist support in his conservative area by taking the stand. But it's hard for me to believe that this man is a Christian and has access to the first and second commandments. It would be hard for me to believe that this man is a Jew and has access to the Torah. It's hard for me to believe that this guy is a Muslim and has access to the Quran, because you would have a very difficult time using those sacred scriptures from those three religions and supporting a point of view like he's demonstrated. There are a lot of fights going on within a person and among people. But unless a person is fighting for a living like a boxer or a wrestler or some other person like that, the driving force of fighting is fear. This doctor somehow has interpreted the different viewpoints and perhaps President Obama's race, which is an issue below the surface for so many people, if it's even below the surface at all, as a threat to one or more of his needs. Today is Easter, one of the two most important events in the formation of Christianity. Perhaps the birth of Christ is a requirement, birth of Jesus, and then the resurrection from his death is the second. This holy day represents Jesus' demonstration of man's power over physical death. In other words, our physical death is not our death at all. So today, I ask, where has Jesus gone? When I look at that doctor, I wonder, and it seems odd to me, that a doctor, or any sane person for that matter, could be incensed or angry or in fear over another person's desire to have access to adequate medical care. It seems odd that people professing to be a doctor can feel more strongly about limiting health care to wealthy select group versus leveling this important playing field so everybody would have access to this in the United States. Why is it us against them? It seems pretty obvious that everyone benefits from a healthy citizenry in this country, and it seems obvious to most of us that the largesse of this country isn't limited to only a few, and that the abundance could be shared with others, and that abundance doesn't decrease our own, but in fact increases it by the creation of greater opportunity for everybody. Love thy neighbor as thyself. Politically, I think it's, and emotionally in a lot of different ways, financially even, economically, fear is what drives the haves to keep having at all costs. Fear is what drives the have-nots to think that the real problem is that the haves, rather than the underutilization of their own abilities, is the problem. We listen to fear so often, and this is a surprising thing because, if anything, Jesus and his teachings, his life, leads us to abolish fear. But that gets overlooked, obviously. And if fear was speaking, fear would be saying to someone, you have something and the others are trying to get it from you. Fear is saying to another group, you don't have something because others have too much and they are preventing you from having it. I think both of those are lies. Truth would say something like, you don't lose just because somebody else gains. There is abundance. When you try to hold on to what you have, in fear, you stop creating what you want. A level playing field benefits all in the process of creating the lives you want. Preventing people from living their lives doesn't improve yours. Just the opposite, in fact. I have a degree in history, and a lot of my education occurred in the classroom in Latin America, but also outside of the classroom in Latin America. And it was very obvious to me and others that in Latin America, the haves were doing everything they could to hold on to what they had. Regardless of how they came about having it, the source of that acquisition, the means of that acquisition, wasn't to be questioned, but they had it now, and they were preventing the haves, the have-nots, from getting it. And every time somebody said, I would like to educate my child, I would like to feed my family, I would like health care for my family and myself, the group that branded them communists would immediately get American support. We would immediately support the people who were seeking to maintain the status quo. This was true in El Salvador, Honduras, Guatemala, throughout Latin America. Throughout Latin America. And it's based upon a false premise that there's not enough. And it's based upon the false premise that stuff is what makes us happy. It is well known in the field of stress studies and so on that fear makes people dumber as thinkers and faster as reactors. People who incite fear do so to increase their own power and influence over the herd. Fear causes people to clump together into a herd. It does the same thing to blood cells in the body, for that matter. Interesting. People who get their fear activated put themselves into the herd where they are disadvantaged intellectually in all ways, but are supported by the size of the herd. They feel, because there's so many of us, maybe I'm safer. But if you just think of a mob that's been incited and is out of control, you would recognize the mob is not advantaged. It's disadvantaged as well. And if you go back, you go, wasn't it a mob that demanded Jesus' execution? Wasn't it the mob? Jesus demonstrated many things. One of the things that's significant to me that is overlooked, it appears, is equality of acceptability. That could be phrased in a bunch of ways. But Jesus accepted people. The people that he found challenging to accept were the ones who worked the hardest at keeping the playing field unlevel. Pharisees, others in control, the rulers, the powerful. Separating people by a variety of characteristics has long been a human behavior. From a survival standpoint, it's helpful to be able to distinguish your husband or wife or your mate from a saber-toothed tiger. So being able to, there is a difference, can increase our chances of survival. But when we start using characteristics as race, creed, color, gender, on and on and on and on and on, we start to limit our ability to perceive. We start to go to the point where we're only looking at the surface. And that's a primitive approach. That's a primitive man behavior. As a child, and even as an adult today, I love the way Jesus taught. He taught people to look deeper, to think deeper, to think at all. He encouraged people to think because he taught using a form that we label parables. The difference between being told what to do and being taught using parables is that parables offer a richness in the story, in the context. There's a richness in the depth of the story, and the person could go deeper depending on their intellectuality or their interest or their willingness to devote that mental energy to it, and the breadth of it, how widely applied some of these principles in Jesus' parables could be. So instead of simple rules, do this, don't do this, parables offered a much greater field of understanding for those that were willing to explore that. Even though Jesus taught that way, he still supported those two commandments. And I suppose if I knew enough about the Bible, I could find support for other commandments of the Bible. But those two, love your God with all your heart, mind, soul, and love thy neighbor as thyself, seem to be world-changing points of view. Now, I don't know about that doctor, and I'm interested to see how this unfolds over the next week. He certainly has made himself a teaching point and maybe a catalyst for some good. Undoubtedly, good will come out of this example that he set because of the conversations that will arise out of it. Maybe he sees his medical practice as himself, that being his medical practice is his identity, and that now all of a sudden he perceives that himself slash practice is under attack by the government, by the president, by Democrats, by minorities, by people wanting health care for their families and themselves. Seems kind of unusual, but we'll find out. I'm curious, particularly, about how the government and governmental programs have benefited this doctor and his family to achieve their current status. You know, it's always people that say, oh, you know, government shouldn't do this, government shouldn't do that. But when you start investigating, you start going below the surface of this stuff, you find government contracts, political connections, people got special treatment because of a good old boy network or some other affiliation. Historically, in the United States, we talk about rugged individualism. This country was built on rugged individualism. Yeah. We've elevated a few people to that kind of status, but when you start examining their lives, even the wealthiest today, and you start examining some of our historical characters, you recognize it's a myth. Rugged individualism is a myth. Because underneath that, it's networks, support systems, friends, helping hands, generosity and compassion of other people, the all forms of support that people apparently acting as if they heard the second commandment, love thy neighbor as thyself, and implement that into their lives. The biggest helping hand in America is labeled the government. But the government really consists of people. There is no government. There is no individual who is government. There are people that are elected or appointed office that make decisions to keep stuff for themselves or to level the playing field or to make opportunity more widespread, to ignore the Second Commandment, or to apply the Second Commandment. Undoubtedly, you could look at Washington, D.C., or any state capital in the United States of America, or any governmental capital anywhere in the world, and you could find the current-day Pharisees. You could find people talking about Christianity, and you could also find people acting like Jesus, acting like they heard what he said, and they're applying what he said. I've noticed this pattern over time, that organizations, that is, a person connects to another person, and starts an organization of two or more people. And they start because of economy of scale. It's more efficient. They can help one another, and they can do good. They can help other people. Then over time, what seems to happen is those organizations morph into protecting the organization at the expense of the people that they were originally created to serve. They start because they want to serve people, or they're fighting some other organization, and then ultimately they're all about protecting the organization. Human beings seem so quick to jump to judgments and blame others for their own fearfulness. This is true for me. It's not about them. It's about us. And it's not about you. It's about me. To believe that controlling other people or things is what's going to make me safe or happy, is so totally incorrect. It doesn't work. It has not worked. It will not work. Not going to work. Instead, we have the opportunity to apply what it says in that second commandment, love thy neighbor as thyself. So let's just go to the second part of that statement, as thyself, as thyself. I can make the case that that's what's going on. People are loving their neighbors as they love themselves, which is not enough, which is insufficiently. Since we lack sufficient self-love based upon our own training, that's what we're demonstrating. We don't have anything to give. We're looking to hold on to that little bit of self-love, and we're not accessing it. We're not creating it. We're not magnifying it. We're not practicing it. And so we lack neighborly love. It seems pretty obvious to me personally that my own tendency to fault-finding and to believe in not-enoughness, I think that's a real concept, capital N, not capital E, enoughness, not-enoughness, are from my earliest training. My parents taught me those, well, I think they would have thought of them as truths, but they're falsehoods. Fault-finding, scanning the horizon, looking for threats, finding things to find fault with, is to push away an opportunity to be loving. It is a violation of both of those commandments because it doesn't give us an opportunity, me particularly, to notice the God within other people and things and situations. It doesn't give me an opportunity to look for the Christ within them as well as myself. This talk was partly triggered sitting in traffic the other day behind a car that had a bumper sticker on it. Namaste. Namaste is an Asian expression that I've heard translated as the God in me sees the God in you. Just the God in me sees or notices or appreciates or acknowledges the God in you. I thought, I don't do that. I don't do that. I don't do that enough. Occasionally, but that's not my habit. Fault finding is more of the habit. And that's something that separates us from good. Why? Oh, I'm too busy. I'm too busy seeing the quotes bad. I'm not noticing the good. Because I'm so busy looking at the weeds, I'm not noticing the flower. I'm so busy scanning for threats, I'm not seeing the friends. But because of this training that took place so early in my early years, and frankly, those two points of view, fault-finding and not-enoughness, fault-finding was a theme of my mother's experience. It's a way that she used to try to keep herself safe, but it really is not a way to be safe. It's a way to be in pain and unhappiness. And my father believed in not-enoughness because that's how he was trained. And so you can't find happiness through fault-finding. And you can't discover yourself by believing in not enoughness. But because that training took place so long ago in my own life, there's absolutely no excuse for me continuing that habit pattern. No excuse. No excuse. There only could be a couple of false alibis. One is lack of awareness, and I don't have that that's not viable. And stubbornness, holding on to primitive behaviors. Well, on the one hand, you say, yeah, well, that's what I'm doing. Clearly, I'm doing that. But there's no real justification for that. There's no justification for that. We can rise above that. Today is Easter. Jesus demonstrated something of our spiritual nature with his resurrection. He showed a deeper truth about our existence that should give us peace. It should eliminate our primitive fears, primitive greed, primitive need to acquire stuff, because we're far above physical stuff. Where did Jesus go? I don't think he went anywhere. He has been here the whole time. He has been here the whole time, and he will continue to be. Why we don't notice him, that's a whole different story. That's our vibration. One of my favorite series of books is The Life and Teachings of the Masters of the Far East, written over 100 years ago. It's a group of Americans traveled to India, Tibet, and China to meet with spiritual masters to understand how they were doing what we consider to be miraculous activities. And this is documented by one of these participants, Baird Spaulding, and that's what the series of books is about, and he's the writer, the author of them. And in it, he talks about Jesus showing up and speaking to them, and Jesus saying, I'm always around. People can't see me because their vibrations are such that they can't perceive me. Their vibrations are lower. They're lower. They're in fear. They're in other lower vibrational forms. They can't perceive. They don't receive and notice my presence. You can see me now because of the influence of these other masters on you and your own longing to see me. That's why I'm visible to you. You have desired to know me. You can see me, you can understand me, you can resonate with me. I didn't go anywhere. I have been with you the whole time. He doesn't say this, but I would bet he would say, please, please notice me. Please vibrate at a higher level so you can know me and what I have taught, so you can know God the way I know God. I think Jesus and that Christ within, his presence is in us and around us. And no better time to resurrect his presence in us than on Easter. I would like to end this service with a prayer. Father God, Mother God, Christ, the Creator and connection to all that is, thank you for expanding our awareness, helping us to see through the falsehood of appearances, to connect to you, and connect to your other creations. Connect to our neighbors, connect to other beings, connect to things that you have created, to connect to ourselves as a creation of yours. Help us to love ourselves. Help us to love our neighbors. Help us to be more inclusive as to what a neighbor is, and not limit it to people that look or think or act or live exactly the way we do, but in fact to accept the beauty and the majesty and the magnificence of the varieties of your creation. Help us to look at others and see the God within them. Help us to look at ourselves and to know and act from that place of the God within. Thank you. It is so. Amen.